some of the stars through the airwaves and on the big screen. Coming to you live from Hollywood, it's Rated G Radio with your host, Garrett Miller. Hey, everybody, welcome to Rated G Radio. Believe it or not, we're having a wacky summer schedule, and this is the start of our brief, I'm calling it a summer vacation week, because I've got so many things going on this summer, and where I have people scheduled for the show, I'm like, this is fantastic. Like today we have award-winning best-selling author Darlene Quinn, who's one of my favorite people, coming back to the show. It's been way too long, and I can't wait to have Darlene on in just a couple of moments. Tomorrow on Rated LGBT Radio, Rob Watson and I are going to be talking about stuff in the LGBT community. And Friday, on the Friday Night Dance Party, with a special start time of 6 p.m., we're going to have Jonathan Cavier. I think I'm pronouncing that the correct way. At 6 p.m., and Lexica returns to the show at 7. So we're having a doubleheader on Friday night, and that starts with a special start time of 6 p.m. on Friday. I'll tell you a little bit about a lot of the fun stuff that's going on in the world at the end of the show. But at the beginning, we want to get to our special guest star, who's been, again, one of my favorite authors. I've met her. I always say, you know, tell everybody the 7 degrees of separation from you and Kevin Bacon. I met Darlene, probably about 2 years ago at Southern California Writers Association. And she's one of the friendly people that came up to me after the event, shook my hand and became a friend. Along with Kathy Porter. So I have both of those talented authors to, you know, lay claim to fame to know and call my friend. But we stayed in contact. Darlene had been on the show, and she has a book out called Conflicting Webs, and it's a continuation of her series of conflicting things that are going on in the world. And so it seemed like now is a great time to bring her back and talk about all the drama and intrigue and things that are going on. And so, Darlene, my favorite friend today, welcome back to the program. How are you?
I am thrilled to be back with you. You are one of my favorite interviewers.
Yay! Well, I love to hear. Thank you. Your check cleared then, so that's always a good sign. So, yes. Darlene, we're going to talk all about conflicting webs, and I have, I limited it to the 6 key things that I thought were going on in the book, and so I want to talk all about that. But what's been going on in your world since we last had you on the show? Because you've been quite busy doing everything.
I have been busy doing everything. A lot of it has to do with books, and I've talked to a lot of wonderful, wonderful people. And one of the nice things, I think we talked before about my checkered resume.
Yes.
And I have a past that includes a whole bunch of different things. And I was a school teacher, and I was corporate training director for a large group of stores on the West Coast, Bullock's, and on the management team of their specialty store, Bullock's Wilshire. I worked with the Miss Universe pageant in the Long Beach portion, did things in the community. And it kind of sounds like I was displeased and I kept changing jobs, which is absolutely untrue. I loved everything I did.
Okay.
I just kept finding things I liked better. And becoming an author has been by far the most exciting things, because what I find is I get to write about and talk about my greatest passions. And what? I meet a lot of wonderful, wonderful people, such as you, Garrett.
Oh, well, thank you. You know, I think one of the things that I love about what you do and why you do it is that you really choose to live your life filled with passion and purpose. And you've now turned that into a very successful, you know, I say second or third or fourth or fifth career as you go, you know, throughout the course of life. And for people who didn't hear the interview before, maybe hearing your name for the first time, number one, shame on you. But number two, were you always a good storyteller like you are today?
I grew up being a good storyteller. I grew up with some radio shows, Let's Pretend, which started off my Saturday morning. However, I also was in the era where the school system thought it would be a really wonderful idea to teach sight reading rather than phonics. Therefore, my greatest creativity tended to come in spelling, which resulted in little red circles all over my paper. My papers actually always had the measles, which did not inspire me to become a writer of the written word. So I did not go in that direction. I never dreamed of becoming an author. What happened is, throughout my life, different things have happened, and I've changed. My change of career has been sometimes from some bumps in the road, some things that where I had to change direction, and others were just because I was inspired to do so. Probably my first change of direction came, I was a happy school teacher. I loved working with little kids. I taught from kindergarten through the eighth grade at different times. I loved it. Never thought about looking for something else until my one-year-old daughter was diagnosed as severely deaf.
Oh, wow.
And I needed to stop teaching. Probably, you know, I think it doesn't matter so much what happens to you, but what you decide to do with it. At that particular time, I had to give up teaching, which I thought was really terrible, and I became a single mother of two small children. From there, when I had to get a job, is when I became corporate training director of the Bullock's department stores. Now, that seems like sort of a leap, but what happened is I had this wonderful resume, all this checkered resume. You know, I worked with the Miss Universe pageant. I did public relations, charm classes, modeling classes. Oh, I did a little stint as a model, a ramp model, and then I taught those classes. So I had this wonderful resume, which was exactly like being all dressed up with nowhere to go.
Right.
And I didn't type.
It's a great analogy.
I had not typed. In fact, do people even talk about typing anymore?
I do.
Anyway,
but
I hadn't done that.
I don't know. Yeah.
I hadn't done that thing since I was in college.
Uh-huh.
And when I was in college, it was on a manual typewriter.
Oh, yeah.
I knew nothing about electric typewriters, word processing, computers. I mean, that was just foreign to me.
Sure.
So I decided, well, I had two small children, and at the time when my daughter became 5 years old, I no longer got alimony, so I needed to get a job. And I had done some work with hospitals doing public relations, self-improvement courses, and they paid extremely well. But when you work 4 or 5 hours a month, that doesn't help a lot.
Right.
So I went out and I rented an electric typewriter. Fortunately, someone was looking over me, and I never got a job using a typewriter because I probably would not be doing too well. But I decided I had this resume. I knew it was, you know, as I say, all dressed up, nowhere to go. I knew enough that if I sent my resume into a personnel office, that I might get a response of, oh, that's very interesting. If anything comes up, we'll give you a call.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to an employment agency, and they said, well, you worked with Bullock's before. Well, what I was a private contractor doing charm classes and modeling classes. But I decided, okay, you know, I could do that. So instead of going to the personnel office with this lovely checkered resume, I called Bullock's department stores, and I wanted to know who was in charge. And I got the name of the CEO of the company. And so that's where I sent my resume. Something that sounds so weird happened to be brilliant. I didn't know how brilliant that was at the time. Now, the CEO of a company is not going to ask you to come in for an interview. But what that CEO does is he says, here is this, take care of it, to a person in charge, which happened to be the director of organization development. And through a series, which I won't take you to, I became corporate training director of 26 department stores on the West Coast. And so, as I say, what seemed like a dumb way, and later when I joined the management team of the Bullock-Swulshear and reported directly to the president, I realized the power of people going to the top. Because when my boss would say, hey, Darlene, and he'd hand me a letter of paperwork, would you take care of that? At least it meant that person came in and talked to me.
Right.
They might not get the job, but at least it opened the door.
Mm-hmm.
So I would suggest anybody that's out there looking for a job, go to the top. And there's lots of people out there willing to help you.
Isn't that a novel concept that, you know, it's and, you know, this is a book for a different day and a different topic altogether, but there was a book that was out several years ago. And, you know, the process behind it was, you know, kind of original in a non-original way, but it always started for people who were doing business prospecting. I think maybe you're the pioneer of this and you just didn't even know it. But it's, you know, you send a letter to like the CEO, the president, and maybe the CFO or the CTO or something like that, and say, you know, hey, I'm looking to figure out who to talk to, who should I talk to, and I'm sending this letter to all three of you, so maybe you can direct me to the right person. And, you know, using that same concept, you know, you're basically leveraging them like, ugh, I don't want to hear from Darlene, I don't want to hear from Howard, okay, Bill, would you take care of this and call, you know, Bill, you know, Joe back and, you know, deal with this, because we don't want to have him calling our offices. And you mastered that long before this was an art form. So I think you're a pioneer as far as, you know, starting at the top.
Well, I just kind of stumbled into it. At the time, I knew I had to get a job that, making a nice hourly wage was great, but you had to have more than a few hours a month.
Right, right. Oh, my goodness.
Anyway, so, all of the different things that I have done have been kind of grist for the mill as far as writing. They've all helped me in different aspects. And I never knew I was writing a series of books. That never occurred to me. But the next bump in my road was when my daughter, who was severely deaf, was in high school and was having a really difficult time. And I decided I needed to be home with her. Also, at that time, my late husband was head of environment for Shell Oil and was able to, his territory included Hawaii, and so there were places I wanted to travel. And reporting to the president, taking 2 weeks off was a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so I resigned from my job to handle some other things and decided I really wasn't ready for retirement. You know, after I cleaned the closets, I don't like repetition a whole lot. So that's when I started writing. I decided to write some things. Savvy Magazine was one of the first ones, but I was doing business-related things, interviewing mm-hmm. skills, negotiating skills, time management, the things that I had business-wise. And then I decided I better take a writing class and learn kind of what I'm doing. And,
That's helpful, right?
I hadn't typed since I was in college on a manual typewriter. And my daughter had an Apple. When the Apples first came out, home computers were not where they are today. I mean, very few people had personal computers. Most computers were great, big, gigantic things that were in businesses. But my daughter had this little Apple computer. It had one floppy drive. Many people mm-hmm. out there probably don't know what a floppy drive is. But that was even before hard drives. And so I was writing these articles for these magazines on her Apple computer.
Mm.
The problem with having one floppy drive is if you spell things wrong, it would come up as an error for my own name, my street, but I couldn't add anything to the dictionary because there was no place for it to go.
That's right.
So although I got some pretty good money for the articles, but I figure maybe I made 5 cents an hour by the time got it into the machine and back out. And so that probably wasn't going to do it. But all of these things, when I went back to learn a little bit about writing, and one of the things that I was an assignment in the class was to write a poem. And I thought, I don't write poems. You know, this is not right. I can't write a poem. But I'm somewhat compulsive, and so when the day came up that poem was due, I sat in the parking lot in the school, and I did my sort of non-rhyming poem. It was a poem about my teenager that didn't come home. And the teenager that didn't come home happened to be a 1997 Jaguar who spent more time in the repair shop. It was sort of a tongue-in-cheek kind of thing, which my father thought was brilliant. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just had one of these supporting kind of fathers, and he sent it in to this poetry contest. And it won this thing to become in a poetry anthology. And by winning that, I was able to do a correspondence course, and I could choose fiction or nonfiction. So I thought, I'll try fiction. And again, with this compulsion of mine, there were things like write this in 3 different viewpoints, and I thought, I don't know how to do that. But then the paper was due. So I did, and then I really got turned on. I loved fiction. I loved creating characters that you really care about and intriguing plots. There have been discussions going on with writers forever. Is it plot or is it character? Which, it's got to be both. You know, I have to have a character that I really care about to make me keep turning pages.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't just be sitting there not doing anything. They have to be doing important things. And this is something I try to put in all of my characters so that they have issues that are in today's world, real issues, and with no easy solutions, no easy right or wrong solutions, because that's what keeps me turning the pages. My books are written, I love thrillers. Thrillers have attracted me. But I'm not fond of serial killers, of chopped up bodies or mutilation. But I love, what I like thrillers is the reader knows more than any one of those characters. So I write, I don't chop up bodies.
Darlene, my line with you is breaking up a tiny little bit.
Oh, I'm sorry.
There
is
we go.
Is this any better?
That's wonderful. Perfect.
Okay. Anyway, I like that kind of tension that comes with the thriller. So my books are written in a thriller style. And that's with the reader always being a step ahead of any one of the characters and are part of the story. Conflicting Winds, which is my latest novel, is like all of the others. I have a stand.
And Darlene, our line is breaking up again. I don't know if it's the location for your cell or not.
Okay. I'm not on a cell.
Oh, goodness gracious. Okay.
Okay, wait a minute. Let me go closer to the window.
Okay.
Is this helping?
I think so. Isn't that crazy?
Okay.
Now you're good.
Okay. All right. And I sort of lost
my... Well, you were telling us that The Conflicting Webs is your latest novel.
Right. And as I said, I never thought about writing a series. When I first got into and decided fiction was really fun, I took a class at Long Beach City College on novel writing, and the teacher was very encouraging. He says, oh, wow, he says, this reminds me of Alex Haley All About Books. You know, Haley wrote about the airports, about hotel, and but mine was all, my industry was all about the world of department stores and fashion. And however, I was writing in memo style. I hadn't transitioned from that. So I worked and worked on that to try to get the characters right, to get the plot right, to do all of these things. And then I really loved what I was doing. It was just, you know, I couldn't stop. But I didn't think of a series. I thought it'd be awesome to write a book, to finish a book. And then what happened is my characters had other ideas. They were not through. So I am currently writing my second, my seventh book in the series I did not know I was writing.
Isn't that amazing?
Now, most of it started out, the background of all of mine is the fashion industry. I think you should, you know, as all writers are told, write what you know. As long as what you know is something that could be different and open up a world that not everybody knows about. And I think I do know some things. I know a lot less about many things than a lot of people, but I know a lot more about the fashion industry and the world of department stores. And they have so many fascinating personalities.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes people say, how do you create characters? Well, characters kind of just come to me. I worked with the movers and shakers in the industry right at the time we're starting to plummet, when the business of the world became the taking over of businesses in the late 80s, early 90s, through leverage buyouts. Things that piqued my interest were these corporate takeovers, and Bullock Fulcher was one of the victims of the largest retail takeover, and that was the Federated Department Stores. From that, very quickly in fiction, fiction must be believable. True life does not have that restriction. And therefore, my favorite writer in my first book, Webs of Power, liposuction, a hair transplant, and he fills the pool with mineral water. But since fiction has to be believable.
And Darlene, we're losing your connection again.
Oh, I don't know what to do. Now maybe I'll open the window. Will that help?
I don't know, but I just want to make sure we hear you, so I just wanted to let you know.
Now I'm afraid you're going to hear the ocean.
Well, that would, you know, as a backdrop to a story by Darlene Quinn, are you kidding me?
Okay, here you go. Does that work?
I hope so, yeah, but I can hear you great now.
Okay.
But
anyway.
I got the liposuction hair transplant and the swimming pool filled with mineral water.
Oh, right. And, however, the real person that this is after, because I write faction, is patterned over the takeover of the Federated Department Stores. A Canadian, Robert Campo, came to the U.S. He'd already taken over the Allied stores, which was Brook Brothers, Bonwit Tellers, Ann Taylor, was driving them into bankruptcy when he had his eye on Bloomingdale's. And he decided to go after all of Federated. And he couldn't do it, and he sold off the West Coast to Macy's, which was
mm-hmm.
Bullock's Fulcher, and iMagnets.
Mm-hmm.
So the real corporate raider, when you're reading Webs of Power and you see this insane, I made him an Australian instead of a Canadian. I changed the names of the people and the places to protect the guilty.
Yep, there you go.
And all of the idiosyncrasies of this man were true. He had all of those things that I described. He also had the wife and family in different places. But I have such wonderful material of real people doing things as far years, the professional lives of the people in my stories are absolutely on the mark. The personal lives are pure fiction. I never let the real facts get in the way of a good story. Now, are you able to hear me okay with these waves?
You are great right now. It's like we're next door, so this is perfect.
Okay, can you hear the waves?
Not really, surprisingly. And I've got the headphones turned way up, so I think it's probably just, you know, your background distraction for you. But I hear you great now.
Oh, good. Okay. Anyway, conflicting webs. I have followed the retail landscape throughout all of my books, as I say, never letting facts get in the way. And today's world is very different than when I started reading. When I became an avid reader, I could read. I loved reading, and once I got past my initial bumps, and I would read books with very long chapters. Now I find that authors that still write in long chapters, I tend to get their books in audiobooks. And the reason is the time I have to read. Any author has to read a lot. You can't write. If you're not reading, you just can't write. You don't have the tools to do it. And so I do a lot of audiobooks, and that's for my downtime. I never would sit down with an audiobook. If I can sit down and have time to read, then I want a book in my hand.
Right.
And although my books are available in all formats, they're hardback, they're paperback, they're ebook, and they're audiobook, my preference is a real book to hang on to. But the only time I have to read that kind of book is at night right before I go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So I love the short, bite-sized chapters. So inspirations for...
Isn't it odd how our reading patterns have changed over the years? Because, again, you know, you used to have 20-page chapters, and now so many books are maybe 4 or 5 pages at most, and some are even shorter than that for their chapters. But it kind of falls in line with what's going on from a social media standpoint, or even, you know, reading your news online. You know, if you can't get the, you know, basic facts in 2 or 3 sentences or 2 or 3 paragraphs, you know, you're pretty much done. Or even Twitter with 140 characters. You know, and I wonder, Darlene, I'm going to ask you this question. You know, do you think that helps or hurts us as a society when we are taking, you know, let's say a major story and saying, oh, okay, I'm going to learn everything I need about what's going on in, you know, 140 characters or less, and then I'm going to go be the expert on social media and tell everybody else what to think. You know, I see a lot of that, and I'm not sure if that's necessarily a good thing or a bad thing, but it's interesting that, you know, it seems that has changed for us. I don't want to say overnight, but it's, you know, been seemingly overnight where we've gone from, you know, long, detailed, rich stories, you know, with all the facts and everything, to, you know, 3 sentences or less. What do you think about that?
Well, I'm pretty windy, so I can't do the short characters. But I think it's something we have to accept, that our society has changed.
Mm-hmm.
In our ADD world right now, now when I say I write bite-sized chapters, I usually will stop at a scene. I don't cut off the story when I'm writing, but I will stop at the end of a scene when you want to know, hey, what happens next, where some writers will just keep going in that one thing. You get it all. You just get it in several chapters. And I don't think we can fight it. I think what has happened is the texting is something that I think has really gotten this short kind of communication back and forth. But it's the world we live in. We can't fight it. And so I write to that. Well, I can only write what I want to read. You know, I like to read the short, bite-sized chapters. I don't want less information. But, yes, for news, I think you're absolutely on the mark. for news, I like that just broken down. But why is that? The reason, I think, is we don't have as much time. When I was growing up, if I was expecting a phone call, I had to stay home.
Right.
I couldn't be out someplace else and get this phone call. I had to stay home.
Darlene,
it limited what I was doing. If I was meeting somebody at Disneyland.
Right. I totally agree with you. So what do you think changed in our society that made all of us, and I'm talking about all of us in the global sense, not you or me, because we all fall victim to this in some capacity, but what do you think changed in our lives that made us all so self-important that, you know, we can't stay home for a phone call, or we can't watch a 30-minute news program, or we can't read a, you know, New York Times article, or we can't read a 30-page chapter? Why do you think we have changed as, you know, and this is not having to do with the Twitter part of it, but I think it goes to the fact that, you know, oh, my time is so valuable that, you know, whether it is or not, maybe a different story. But, you know, we all fall victim to that, you know, about, I just can't be bothered with that. You know, don't they know who I am syndrome? I'm fascinated by that.
I think it's technology. Mm. We couldn't do those things before. We didn't have the technology to get a phone call when we're out doing something else.
Right.
As far as multitasking is concerned, the more multitasking you do, the less effective you are in any one aspect. And yet, in today's world, if you can't multitask, you're in trouble.
Right.
Because there's too much going on. And because of the technology, so that we can always be on track, you know, you get irritated if you can't get a hold of someone. Before, we used to just know they must not be home. That's
right.
Not an excuse anymore.
Oh.
You know, we ran out of excuses with the technology.
Are you married to your iPhone or your iPad and that as you're running around town?
I'd like to say no, but that wouldn't be truthful.
Okay.
I would really like to say no, but I am. However, I am able to turn off, like when I'm out with friends and doing social things, I do put that aside.
Okay.
A lot of people cannot do that. But
was that hard for you?
No. Well, I happen to have an awesome husband, and which is a big help, because one of the things that I do, like when we're going out socially and doing everything else, he does the driving. Therefore, I get caught up on my iPhone and all of this stuff as he's driving. So I have some extra time there. Otherwise, I think it would bother me, but I am pretty disciplined in terms of knowing. I used to teach time management. I do an excellent job, not very well sometimes. But I know how, and I know the things that I should do. And when I have a social event that I'm going to, I try to prepare ahead of time so that I will not be distracted.
There you go.
Lately, I've gotten some wonderful speaking engagements with some just awesome people. I did a women's state convention recently, and it used to be that some of the things that you could talk to people about, a group of women, were how to fill in those empty hours. There is no such thing now.
Right.
If there are women out in a women's convention, they are not trying to figure out how to fill those empty hours. They're trying to figure out how to fit everything they need to do into the given time.
Mm-hmm. And I think
this
that's
is an interesting interview, Garrett. I have never done an interview out on my balcony. It's really pleasant. I love it.
Well, you sound great, so maybe you should do all of your interviews from the balcony or something like that. That would be.
Maybe I should. I love the sound of the ocean there. I have a nice cool breeze. It's wonderful.
It adds to the ambiance, you know. I think this is—it's a first. It's our first oceanside chat, so that'll be fun.
Yeah, hey. It's too bad you can't see. You could look over at the Queen Mary. The Queen Mary sits in my front yard.
Well, I for everybody who doesn't know, Darlene lives in Long Beach, California. So if you're around the country, around the world, the Queen Mary is stationed here in Long Beach as a tourist attraction. And if you ever come, you know, come to the area, you have to go see it, and you can have dinner on the Queen Mary, have a lovely meal, and, you know, some entertainment. I hear it's also haunted. Have you been on the Queen Mary?
Oh, of course. Yes. My late husband was an Englishman. And so we've gone on the tours of it and gone on sister ships of the Queen Mary. And, yes,
did
it does have a haunted
ghosts?
House.
Hmm? Yeah. Did you ever run into any ghosts?
I'm not sure. Actually, the first ghost that I think I ran into was at Bullock's Wiltshire. And it
really?
Was supposed to, it is known for having ghosts. And up
okay.
in that big tower, are you familiar with the Bullock's Wiltshire building?
I know where that's at, but I've not been inside.
Well, it's a historic monument. Well, and actually, it's on every single one of my books. It's the tower building on every single one of my books, if you look at them, because my stores in there are Bullock's Wiltshire, which I call
mm-hmm.
Bentley's and Bentley's Royale.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And anyway, on that tower, there were supposed to be ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
And so going up into the tower and the patrons, we don't, at Bullock's Wiltshire, we did not have customers. We had patrons.
Oh, I love
and
that.
They, of course, could not go up in the tower, but some of us on the management team could do that, and they kept up on that tower. They kept all of their supplies, display things, up in the room. And going up there, I went up there because Webs of Fate is set with a scene up in that tower. So I needed to go there and find out just exactly the layout that would go there. And I had this bracelet in my hand that disappeared. Yeah, I was holding it. It disappeared. I
wow.
have no idea what happened to it.
Oh, my gosh. That's crazy.
It was crazy. It kind of inspired me to have the buyer that was up there lose a necklace.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
And there are stories in that store. All the stars used to be there, and there was one with someone committed suicide.
Oh, my goodness.
It wasn't from the tower, but from someplace else. But there are ghost stories from Bullock's Wiltshire. I don't write about those.
Right, right. No,
I write about real things.
Real things, like conflict. Hey,
right.
Okay, before we dive into conflicting webs, because I have all my questions that I want to ask you about for that, one question that is, that comes to mind as we take a look at the theme of your books, because you do write about the retail experience or, characters from a retail family or retail dynasties, if you want to call them that. What's your take on the shrinking, I call it the big box syndrome, but the shrinking big box syndrome where, we see, stores that have been generationally part of our culture like Sears and Kmart or even to a lesser extent like the Circuit Cities or, we could look at any of the other, other types of stores that have shut down over the years just due to changing shopping habits or dynamics of our economy. What do you think that will do for, any of your future writing that you're currently working on?
It has been said since, I don't know, when dime stores came back way back in history, that was going to be the end of department stores.
Mm-hmm.
And then when discount stores, that was definitely the time that department stores were going to become dinosaurs. Department stores have become stronger. They're in trouble right now because our whole globalization, people are buying differently. They're not buying as much into the ready-to-wear kind of thing. They're doing more in entertainment and going out and doing things, traveling. Things are changing and evolving. But it has been, my first book, which I wrote third, the first book in my series was the third one published. And that was because after people read Webs of Power and Twisted Webs, many readers wanted to know about their favorite characters before they hit those pages.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back in time to the mid-80s, which was the beginning of the crumbling of department mm-hmm. stores. And actually, when my first book came out, when Webs of Power came out, was right when we went into the recession in 2008.
Right.
And that's when Circuit City went down, linens and things went down. And they were predicting that the big stores would go down. What happened after the takeover of Federated, and as part of the legacy of my books, the takeover of Federated, and it went into bankruptcy, and one of my characters actually saved it, came back and took over Macy's. But the takeover of those stores has grown. Let me step back. Federated was taken over. Federated went into bankruptcy. It came out of bankruptcy. It took over Macy's and mm-hmm. the Broadway Emporium stores.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then later in 2005, it took over the May Company, Robinson's May, and those stores.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of going out, Macy's has 850 stores, plus 40 Bloomingdale's stores. It has grown to be the largest group of stores. It's in trouble right now because of, and you're going to be seeing things like, in some Macy's stores, they have a Best Buy department. That's something brought in.
That's really, I think that's kind of a smart approach, is to partner up with other companies, that have an expertise. Because you remember, going into like a JCPenney or a Montgomery Ward store, I mean, back in the day, and you would go mm-hmm. buy your 19-inch console television set in the TV department, and you had to kind of hope that, whoever was there, knew what the, color Trinitron monitor or whatever was going to do for you. But, bringing in a Best Buy into a Macy's just sounds like a smart idea.
There's a lot of things that are going on like that. It's kind of an evolution. When I grew up, when I was a kid, you could go to a department store, you could get a TV, you could get a refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
You could get material. You could get notions, and most people don't even know what notions are, but like zippers and thread, and you could get everything in department stores.
Mm-hmm.
And as that went around, and I was, I came on board kind of after this started, but the CEO that I worked with, who is actually Mark Todman in my book, his professional life, decided, hey, we can't compete with TV stores. We can't compete with the experts. So they started outsourcing, they started getting rid of the things that other stores did as a specialty and could, if you wanted a TV, most people would go to a TV store. I mean,
sure.
It was nice. They would, and so they started dropping out of those business. Now I'm seeing them creep back in.
Isn't that funny?
I was there when they stopped having restaurants in department stores. Remember, mm-hmm. you used to go to your favorite department store,
mm-hmm.
and you'd
mm-hmm.
go to their restroom, their tea room, and everything else, and it was so special. Well, they started taking restaurants out. It was a very bad decision. It was an extremely bad decision. The reason they took them out is they started evaluating the value of square footage, how much
mm-hmm.
each square
mm-hmm.
foot generated. Well, restaurants don't generate that much. However, if you are in a store and you get hungry and you leave that store,
you're not likely to come back.
And
right.
So now you will see the stores are coming back with restaurants in them.
Well, you know, it's, you know, we can go to a Target and you've got your Starbucks, you know, cafe that's in there.
Uh-huh.
You can go, you know, you see that all the time now. But, you know, it's interesting because I think that spurred, because I do remember, you know, and I don't know if this is a store chain that you are familiar with, but back where I grew up in Oregon, we had what was called Meyer and Frank. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, my mom would take me there, and on a special occasion, we would get to go up to the restaurant and have, you know, maybe a hamburger or an ice cream sundae or something like that. And it was always a special deal. And then you go back and do more shopping. But as those restaurants yeah. were out of there, you make a great point. They go to another store or they go home or whatever the case is.
Mm-hmm.
But that really opened up the advent of like a food court. And
uh-huh.
I think that didn't end up helping a lot of the retailers out there when, you know, they... You know, can go down and get a little pretzel or an orange Julius or whatever when, you know, and you're driving traffic out of your store.
It didn't help individual stores. It helped groups of stores.
Mm-hmm.
Because it kept people from leaving the shopping mall.
Right, right. So it's,
yeah.
it, you know, if you're in it to help the overall collective, that's great. But if you're, you know, federated department stores, that doesn't help your bottom line. But
right, if you're running a big, expensive tea room.
We have talked for 45 minutes, and we haven't even gotten to Conflicting Webs yet, your latest book. Can we, I mean, I'll talk to you for like another 12 hours, I have a feeling, but let's sell some of your books today. Tell us about Conflicting Webs and why this is such an interesting journey for your characters. And I have questions about some of the topics that you've written about in the book.
Right. Actually, Conflicting Webs is more like a family saga in many respects. This is one of April, a major character. I wouldn't say the main character because there's a lot of characters that sort of people are drawn to other than April. But she is a girl that was born in Webs of Power. She was adopted at that time. Well, Conflicting Webs is a story about family, about lies, deception, betrayal. It is kind of a composite of a lot of the things that are affecting our world today and affecting families. There's an enabling father in this. There is a drug addiction. There is a personality defect, strong health issues, but they're real problems that we face today in certain families, and how you go on from those things, how you deal with those things. What I love to present in my books is real-life situations that have no right or wrong answer necessarily. We all deal with problems very differently, and I hope that some of mine, when you know, people can identify with certain aspects and ask themselves, what would I do in that? My solution isn't necessarily theirs, but it, from what I hear from readers, it stimulates their thinking.
Well, you definitely do that because you have, you know, you've got in the book, like you said, we have the personality disorders, the drug abuse, the, you know, rehab. You know, we have an issue of parental rights coming up with the wedding at the beginning of the book. You know, family rituals, kidnapping, health issues, but, you know, it's conflict. And it's one of these that I think that, at least for me, as I started getting into the book, you know, you're like, oh, this can't happen to Nora now. And then, you know, what's happening here? And then how is Howard such a, you know, muckety muck? And, you know, you start going through these things, but the characters that you write really do leap off the page. At least they did for me. And you, well, Darlene, I'm just going to tell you, every single person that you wrote about, I go, oh, I know somebody who's like this person. I know somebody who's like that person. And so I just kind of like, you might describe them wonderfully, but I'm visualizing my whole other cast of characters, and, you know, they might not even be in the same areas, but it's like, I know people who are like that. And so it was very relatable for me in surprising ways. So I really, I enjoy your style of writing a great deal.
Well, I love people, and I love, you know, I bring up my own solutions. In fact, sometimes I meet readers, and they'll say, you know, well, Twisted Webs is one where there is a kidnapping. I have twins, and on the day of their birth, one of those twins is kidnapped. And the reader finds out right away that they know the kidnapper. He is a good religious man who, out of love and desperation, has taken this child. And throughout this book, the mother of the kidnapped child does not know the child was kidnapped. She thinks it is the child of a mother who wanted a better life for her child, and there's a reason she never finds out. So throughout the book, there is a tug between not wanting this mother to lose the child and yet wanting Ashley, the mother of the child, to get the child back. And one of the things, and it scares people at first, that they're going to be in this tug of war. And the only thing I can say is I love happy endings. And I'm sort of addicted to happy endings. My solution in that book, which I won't tell you what it is one that I've had more people come up and say, you know, I wonder what I do in that particular situation. And in terms of conflicting webs with this enabling father, I've had readers say they'd like to take a hitman for Howard Levine.
But
Howard,
his motivation
Howard is a man who, I mean, he has a big ego. He thinks he's right. He loves his daughter. He absolutely loves his daughter. And he thinks he is right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everything he is doing is enabling her to be the kind of person that he does not want her to be.
Right.
That nobody wants their daughter to be. And he doesn't see it. I happen to know someone exactly like that. And I know that he cares. I know that he feels that the wife has done everything wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And through his, you know, it's hard. I try to get into the minds not only of the protagonist, but the antagonist as well. Because I don't really believe there's anybody that's all good or all bad.
Well,
and
you know,
I try to portray that.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that that's really helpful because, you know, you put this human spin on them. So even if they are, you know, dastardly, and you're like, Howard, stop doing this, which I've said many times throughout the course of the book. But, you know, you kind of get where he's coming from, and you're like, oh, but I understand why you're doing this. But it's so wrong, stop. You know, so there's a lot of, I mean, so as a, you're giving me as a reader here, Darlene, a lot of conflict and how I'm wanting to deal with these characters as well. But I will tell everybody who's listening to the show today, or I say watching the show because, of course, you're on your computer, there is a link to Darlene's Amazon author page. And I put that there specifically because if you want to go get Conflicting Webs, please, A, do that. But, B, this gives you the link to all of her books right there on Amazon. And I'm a big fan of supporting any of the authors any of the guests when they're on the show. For authors, I always say, go out and buy 10 of their books and you say, I don't need 10 copies, but you can buy one for yourself and then gift 9 to other family and friends. And especially if they, you know, have twins or they've got conflict in their families or they're, you know, involved in retail, there are elements of each of these stories that Darlene tells that will really bring you back, you know, time and again. But I loved Conflicting Webs. I'm about halfway through, so I've still got some more reading to do today, Darlene. But, you know, where I'm at right now, I'm just like, I can't believe this is going on. But it's like that every single time. It's like, come on, we've got to have some good news here, finally. But you always
Darren,
wrap it up with a nice
you just reminded me why I love being on your show so much.
We need to sell books.
Absolutely. I'm very careful in my books. I have a series, but they are standalone. I make sure that each book will stand alone. I don't want to bring out a book and say, hey, but you've got to read, get the four books that come before this.
Right.
They all stand alone. And that's a challenge for me as a writer, because I want people to have enough information with each character that they know that character and they feel comfortable with that character, but I don't want to load them down with all this backstory for people that have read all of my books that bore them to death.
Yeah.
So
it's,
I give just
balance.
Enough.
It's I think that's a big gift that you have, and there are other authors that are out there that, you know, you and this is about you, so I'm not mentioning those names today, but there are other authors out there that have recurring characters in their books, and they you know, they either do a really good job at doing exactly what you do, just enough but not too much, or they overkill it and you're like, oh my gosh, I know, I read about this in book 1, 2, 3, and 4.
I know. I've had that too, and it's hard for me because I'm on the staff with Southern California Writers Conference, and I've had authors that I love them as people, and then I read their book, and
like,
I have all this backstory, and I don't need to know it.
Yeah, yeah.
I try to give them what they need to know.
Speaking of other groups, I know that recently you made an appearance at a Barnes & Noble locally. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, that Barnes & Noble, in fact, I'm doing a few what they call meet and greets. Instead of doing book talks where I'm talking, you know, to a large group of people, the meet and greets is where I just come in for a couple of hours with my books and meet new readers. I love to do that, and it's fun to talk to new readers and to meet people. That particular Barnes & Noble in Marina Pacifica Mall, where I have a lot of signed books that they have kept out on the table, I have done all my book launches there. They have hosted me for the launch of each of my 5 novels. And they have a wonderful staff of people. They're so supportive that I love going there. Some authors have decided, oh, you know, bookstores aren't that important anybody. Everybody buys online. And
they,
yet they love bookstores. And if
yeah.
they don't support them, they're not going to be there.
I agree. Darlene, we've got 2 minutes left. And anything that's upcoming that you'd like to talk to us about or things that you would like your fans to know before we let you go today?
Well, right now I'm working on Severed Webs. And we're going to be back with the twins. This book will not be out probably until the end of next year. And the reason for that is I have a lot of research. It's going to involve a semester at sea and a rogue wave and autobiographical amnesia.
Wow.
And, it has been fun. In fact, I met a neurologist, met me for lunch because I needed... Anything that I put in my book has to be real. I mean, I write fiction, and so I have incidents that you know, don't really happen to those people, but they have to be things that can happen, that are possible. I met a neurologist for lunch, and he brought a plastic brain to lunch. I used to say, I told a few people he brought a brain to lunch, which they were horrified, so I have to put in plastic.
Yeah, I would be horrified too, but thanks for the clarification.
And I'm doing some more meet and greets in different areas. I'll be in Irvine and also up in Thousand Oaks in the next few weeks. But on my website, on my Amazon page, you can always find out where I am.
Very good. Everybody, it's been Darlene Quinn, author of Conflicting Webs. There's a link to her Amazon author page. And as I said before, go out and support our guests when they're on the show. Buy 10 copies today. Keep one for yourself.
Okay,
and then
DarleneQuinn.net.
DarleneQuinn.net. Absolutely. Go there for all the latest. It'll be really cool. And just a reminder, we're back live tomorrow night on LGBT Radio with my co-host Rob Watson. We'll be talking current events. And then we've got the Friday Night Dance Party at 6 p.m. Pacific on Friday with Jonathan Cavier in Hour 1 and Lexica joining us again in Hour Number 2. It'll be a pleasure to have her back on the program. If you like the show, make sure to follow us right here. You just click the follow button on the show page, but you can also go to iTunes, you know, podcast thing, and you can find the most recent 300 episodes of the show there, and you can subscribe for free. It's my pleasure to have Darlene on the show today. We'll have her back in another year when her next book is out. That will be so much fun. In the meantime, everybody, have a great day today. Thank you for being here. And whatever you do, please be safe and have fun. Take care.
You've been listening to Rated G Radio.